In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun.
Fun, 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 fun.
Light speed to
the wondrous and wonderful.
Cover is not the book, so open it up and take a look.
Ah, if it isn't the only bookworm in town.
What's that word again?
Inspired.
Might solve a mystery or rewrite history.
This is the story we need. It's a right that's been kept out of sight for no more.
So I'll read a book, or maybe two or three. It's such fun to hum a happy working song. Ooh, a happy working song.
I have to sing. I have to play. The music, it's not just in me. It is me.
We're happier when you don't sing.
Welcome to Notably Disney, your ultimate podcast covering Disney music and books. I'm Brett Nachman, your host. Here we dig a little deeper and explore the great wide somewhere about everything under the Walt Disney Company umbrella as it pertains to tunes and writing, from the theme parks and television screens to the Broadway stage and the silver screen, if it relates to anything Disney songs, soundtracks, books, articles, or other things that you can listen to or read about involving Disney, we'll examine it here. Celebrating its 40th anniversary this year is Splash, the first release from Touchstone Pictures, which was the late film label from Disney, as it aimed to create a space for more adult fare. It was an immediate hit for the studio, one that defined romantic comedies and fantasies for the 80s, and features an unforgettable score from the legendary Lee Holdridge. Lee is the winner of 2 Primetime Emmy Awards, 2 Daytime Emmy Awards, and garnered 18 Emmy Award nominations total, plus 2 Grammy Award nominations. Quite impressive. Lee's body of work for television and film has spanned more than 50 years for productions including East of Eden, Beauty and the Beast, the television series that is, and Moonlighting. And in fact, one of his most enduring pieces of music was for ABC's long-running One Life to Live, the late soap opera for which he won multiple daytime Emmys. And today on Notably Disney, it is really my distinct pleasure to bring on a composer whose enchanting scores have delighted us for generations. Thank you for joining me today, Lee.
It's my pleasure to be here, Brett. Thank you for inviting me.
I have a list on my computer of folks I would be dreaming to talk with, and you've been one of them. So I'm really delighted that you created the space to talk with me about not only one of your great scores, but also your career more generally.
Well, I started on the violin at age 10, which is late, by the way. My father was a scientist, so music was not first and foremost in the household. But I did start hearing music. A lot of his forestry students were musicians, and I heard them playing instruments. And my mother played the guitar. And so I was around music. But then at age 10, it hit me like a thunderbolt. And I wanted to take violin lessons. And I started studying the violin. And by the time I was 12, I was rewriting my violin exercises, which drove my violin teacher crazy. And he said, I think you want to be a composer. And the lightning struck. The light bulb went off. I said, yes, that's what I want to do. And that's all I've ever done since then. And I tell people I've never had an honest job. All I do is write music.
But music makes the world better.
And conduct it many times. But, you know, that's the real work, conducting it. Writing music is something I do every day. It's like breathing. It's just part of my life.
Music makes the world better. And if I remember correctly in an interview that I saw you conduct with the Academy, is it that one of the reasons why you were interested in playing the violin was you heard a child playing it and you went to...
Well, yes, I heard someone playing, and one of my classmates in school was a student, and I said, oh, I love that. You know, I want to do that. So I did. I followed her to, she was going to her lesson, so I followed her, and she went into this apartment building, and I could hear the violin playing in there, so I knocked on the door, and this big gentleman answered the door, and I said, I'd like to take violin lessons. And he looked at me and said, well, have your parents call me, and gave me the phone number. And I had them call him, and I started violin lessons. And everything grew from there.
What was your familiarity with film scores as a child?
Well, I grew up in Costa Rica. And one of the things that we did for entertainment was go to the movies. And I remember seeing movies like Ben-Hur, and, you know, I was a kid in the 50s, or late 50s, early 60s, late 50s mostly. And I saw films like Ben-Hur and stuff like that. And they had this marvelous music that went with them. And it really intrigued me. And these big orchestras and sometimes a chorus, you know, it was very exciting. But I didn't think about being a film composer. I just thought about, I like music. And when I started studying the violin, my focus was on symphonic music, classically training and so forth. I studied classically. I played a lot of the violin literature. I loved the violin literature. And it wasn't until I got to New York years later that I first really started encountering thoughts about working on film as a medium. But up to that point, I'd really written mainly for the recital hall and the concert hall. So my origins are in the symphonic world.
Did you have access to go to the symphony or places where music was performed?
Constantly. I would go to symphony concerts. I would go to, when I started going to high school in Boston, I would go to the theater. There was a lot of shows that tried out of town in Boston. I saw a lot of musicals in their early stages. I watched a lot of plays. I loved plays. I loved the writing. I even tried to write plays, but I wasn't as successful in that. But I really appreciated what goes into it. And I still, to this day, think the key to a movie is the script. If it doesn't have the script, you can put all kinds of ornaments on it. It's not going to work. You got to have that story. You got to have those characters. You've got to have the base of the whole thing. So I've always admired the people that can write the script that create the beginnings of the film. And everything grows from there.
Absolutely. In concert with that, though, I would argue that you could have a bad movie, but the score is amazing, and consequently,
an amazing score hasn't saved a bad movie.
Generally, no, it hasn't.
There are some great scores that from terrible movies that everybody knows underground, but there's some wonderful films that have weak scores, you know, and it's just, but the film is so good, it doesn't matter, you know. So, but right. Generally, when you get the combination of the two, it's magic.
Oh, for sure. Well, yeah. I can think of many bad movies where I'll listen to the score on its own.
And oh, yes. And well, of course. Yeah, that happens. That happens. I'm sure it does, you know. But, you know, as a composer, you always do your best. You try to make things work. And I remember once a director saying to me the scene, he said, the scene needs a lot of help. He said, it needs a lot of help. See what you can do with it. And I was thinking in my head, okay, let's recast it. Let's rewrite the scene and let's redirect it. Of course, I didn't say that. But, I think it was Dmitri Tiomkin that said about film scoring. And he said, composers are like morticians. You can dress the body up and make it look nice, but you can't bring it back to life.
Oh, that's a brilliant quote.
And you know, when the film is good, the score almost writes itself. It's just like if the film is good, you're hooked on it, you get caught up in it, you just can't help it. You come up with something, you know. But if it's not good, man, it's an uphill battle.
You mentioned pursuing a career in music. Was there a defining moment at all in your young adulthood that you felt like was very transformative as it pertained to your musical directions?
Yes. You know, my first violin teacher was Don Ugo Mariani, who was the conductor of the National Symphony Orchestra in San Jose, Costa Rica. And he was an Italian gentleman from Naples who had emigrated to the Americas. He was a principal conductor in New York, and he was in Buenos Aires, and he came to Costa Rica, and he was a wonderful violinist. He was a great teacher. And I went one day, he said, come to a rehearsal. We're rehearsing at the concert hall today. So I went to a rehearsal, and they were rehearsing the Borodin Second Symphony. And there was a flu epidemic in the country, and a lot of the members of the orchestra were out sick. Mm. And he stood at the podium and conducted the symphony and sang all the missing parts. Where there was an oboe solo and there was not an oboist there, he sang the line. He knew the score that well. And I remember sitting there saying, oh boy, there's a lot to learn. And that was the reality, that in order to be really good at it, you really had to study and work hard. And it was just that those early experiences, watching him rehearse and watching him work with the orchestra. And it's all transformative. The biggest breakthrough for me was when I was able to come to live in Boston, and I went to Newton High School. I was going to high school then. And I met Henry Lasker, who was the music teacher at Newton High School, and I studied privately with him. That was the transformative time, because in 3 years of composition studies with him, I learned everything. I, to this day, use the things he taught me. I went to a famous music school after that in college, and it was anticlimactic to what he had taught me. They were trying to teach the same things, and it was atrocious. And the way he taught it was so superb that those were the lessons that stayed with me. I'll give you an example. He walked in one day, sat down at the piano, and he said, let me play you something. And he put some sheet music on the piano, and it was Jerome Kern's Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. He said, this is sonata form. Bum, ba-da-da-da-dum, da-da-da-da. He said, that's the A section. And it repeats. It's a recapitulation. Da, 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 da. And then there's the B section. Da, 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 da. He said, and then it recapitulates at the end again. He said, that's sonata form. Then he put it down. He pulled up a Schubert sonatina. He said, this is the same form. It's just a little longer. You know, and all of a sudden, it clicks in your mind that the form is very important. And when I got to this famous school, they were trying to teach sonata form, and it was like, you know, it was like a math teacher talking about something he had no clue. It was just like they were lost. And the comparison between the beauty and the simplicity, which he played it on the piano, said, here it is, listen to it, you can hear it. And there were a lot of wonderful little tricks he taught me. Like he said, You make a statement, great, you repeat it, that's fine. He said, you're going to do it a third time? He said, maybe do something a little different with it. So to this day, when I'm sitting writing, I turn around and I see him standing there, and I see him shake his head, and I say, okay, I'll work on it some more. So those early teachers were very influential. Nick Flagello in New York, who I studied privately with too, they were very influential. Nick is the one that introduced me to film scoring, because he had ghosted big sections of Dr. Zhivago for Maurice Jarre. And I remember I asked him, I said, how do you feel about film scoring? He says, I feel fine, about me a house in Yonkers. But the truth of the matter is that in the early 60s in New York, if you mentioned film scoring, you might as well have mentioned prostitution. And the academics were so adverse to it. They were so snobby and full of you know what. And their attitude towards film scoring was the same people that looked down their nose at me when I started working on films called me a few years later and said, is there any work out there for us? You know? It's just like the attitude changed. But the truth of the matter is, art is art. It takes many forms. It doesn't matter what the form it takes. There's an artistry in everything you do. There's an artistry in playing a banjo. There's an artistry in playing a violin. There's an artistry in writing a film score. There's an artistry in writing an opera. There's good and bad in both. And the bottom line is, all this snobbery that exists in the academic circles is ridiculous. And in the 60s, it was so heavy. It was absurd. But I just ignored it. I just ignored it. Fortunately, I had enough colleagues that said, oh, just don't pay attention to them. They're full of hot air. And that all changed. But Nick Flagello was highly influential in deflating that balloon and saying, hey, music is music. You know, it's either good or it's bad, you know. But Duke Ellington said it best. He said, if it sounds good, it is good.
That's really poignant. Was Nick a conduit for you in terms of entering Hollywood, or were other folks?
No, not at all. Not at all. What happened for me was I was studying in New York, and I started getting calls from people saying, hey, can you write an arrangement for me? Can you write a piano thing? Can you do this? So I started doing some arranging for people. It was a good way to make a living. And one thing led to another. I met a producer who was producing record artists at RCA at the time. So I started doing arrangements for him. And it was a great, great gig. You know, it was a lot of fun. There were always fantastic musicians around in New York at the time. And somehow through the work that I did for him, I got contacted by Neil Diamond and his people. They wanted me to do some arrangements for them. And I started doing some arrangements for Neil Diamond. And that's what got me into the film business.
And that makes me wonder. So we're talking the 70s, if my time
Well, no, 69 was when 69. The first arrangement I did for Neil Diamond was in 69. I came out here to L.A. and worked with him on an album and then started commuting back and forth between New York and L.A., working on several albums. And as a result of that, I got some calls to do some film work, some film writing. My first film was a film called Jeremy, 1973, which I love. I love the film. It's still a gem of a film. And I got a cello concertino out of it because the main character was a cellist. So I wrote a lot of cues for him to play. So I put it all together into a concertino for cello and strings. And actually a section of it is in the film. The third movement of it, he plays at a concert in the film. And then not long after that, Neil Diamond was engaged to do Jonathan Livingston's The Seagull. And he said he was going to write the score and I would conduct it. I said, okay, fine. So I would go to his studio to meet with him and he would hand me 8 bars and I'd say, well, the cue sheet says 4 minutes and 30 seconds. He said, well, you'll think of something. So the next thing I knew, I was writing a lot of the score. I wound up writing maybe 60, 70% of the score, not the songs, but the orchestral score.
Sure.
And I was very naive at the time, so I asked for credit for it. And of course, they wouldn't give me credit. But I learned after that you've got to have a good agent in Hollywood, someone who fight on your behalf. But anyway, that opened the door. And he thought he could pull it off that he had written the score. But, you know, there are no secrets in Hollywood. Everybody knows everybody's business. So I would get a call from a producer and say, I love what you did on Jonathan Livingston Seagull. He said, you mean what Neil Diamond did? He said, no, I know what you did it. He said, everybody knows. You know, I want you to come and work for me and do the same thing. So there you are, you know, just open doors. So I owe him that. I owe him the fact that he opened the doors for me, you know.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you were very much thrust into composing a lot of that score and you had right. many other projects that yeah. followed.
Well, of course, after that, I learned that you need to get screen credit for what you do. But that was anyway, it was a great experience, you know, and I learned a lot about film scoring, working on those early films. And I did a lot of television at Universal. Universal was, what can we say? That was the college, because that was the university, because here's the thing. You had to write well, and you had to write fast, and you couldn't, like, procrastinate. They would give you a deadline. You had to come in with it, and boom. And if you couldn't handle the pressure, you dropped out, you know. So there were a couple of guys that were genius composers who I thought were phenomenal, but they couldn't handle the pressure. So mm-hmm. they didn't follow through. You had to be able to sort of, they'd say, okay, we need a score in 5 days. You didn't whine, you didn't do anything. You just wrote this. You stayed up for 5 days and wrote the score. And that was great training to just basically get your chops in order so that you could really write and know what you were doing, and you could be very focused on what the composition should be. It was a great training ground. And out of that came, you know, a lot of work.
So who do you train your discipline to? It sounds like you really had to demonstrate a good deal of tenacity. And
well, I wasn't that way at first, Brett. I had to once I got to New York and I started being hired to write arrangements, you realize you have to deliver. You know what I mean? They want the thing tomorrow. And so you force yourself to have to get it done. So necessity is the best teacher, right? You know what I'm saying? I'm not a disciplined person per se, but I had to learn to be disciplined, you know? My father was a scientist. He was disciplined. I was not. I was an artist, you know? I was like, oh, yeah, I'll finish it tomorrow. And he was like, no, you have to do it now. You know?
How did the opportunity to compose Splash come about, if you remember?
Well, by the time I got to Splash, I'd done quite a few films and television. And I met Ron Howard. I did a couple of television movies with him, we worked well together. It was a lot of fun. And he invited me to work on Splash, which was great. I loved the film immediately. The first time I saw it, I said, this is a gem of a film. And at the time, there were some great comedies. I mean, you know, I worked, I guess, on Mr. Mom around the same time, and then Splash, and there were quite a few things. It was a wonderful period for films, as you know. That late 70s, early 80s, there were a lot of terrific films being made. I got to work on The Beastmaster soon thereafter, you know. So, I mean, it was one right after the other, one marvelous project. But I thought Splash was very unique and very special. I could see it right away. I could see it in the film. The script was very clever. The two main actors were so endearing and so likable. You just absolutely... Tom Hanks was magnetic from the get-go. You know what I mean? You knew you were staring at a big star. You said, this guy's going to be a big star. You know, this was one of his early films, as you know. And so it's nice to be there and see those things happen, because you don't always see them, you know. I thought Mr. Mom was a gem, too. This Michael Keaton guy, I thought was amazing. When his performance, he was very... comedic, but he did it in an understated way, which I thought was absolutely a gem. You know, that film, still, you watch it today, it's still a gem, you know.
Yeah, those two folks that kind of at the inception of their yeah. film careers,
right?
I wonder, you said you watched Splash in its entirety and you knew that it was a gem, so it sounds like you watched some version of a finished film prior to...
Well, yeah, I was closer to the finished film. Ron told me later that they had a whole sub-story about an elderly mermaid who had loved a human and had terrible tragedy. And after a while, they decided, oh, it's just weighs the film down. So they took it out. They took this whole thing out and just said, just stayed with the story. So by the time, you know, composers don't always get brought in early in the film. By the time I came in, they were pretty close to that cut that they liked. And I could see even then that it was really terrific, you know. And they may have tightened it up some more after that and everything, but it was really good. Mr. Mom went through a whole different series. Mr. Mom was funny, but it was long, and they took it out of town for a preview and it bombed. And so they came back and they said, what's wrong with it? You know, and so they decided that it needed to be re-edited, that the timing was off. So they fired the two younger, newer editors that were involved in it, and they hired this old-time MGM comedy editor, edited comedies for years. And he came in and he totally changed the timing. I was amazed. It's really a lesson in what an editor can do. He completely changed the timing of that film. And all of a sudden, all the jokes were marvelous, and it worked. And I had to do two scores, because I had already scored it. But because he re-edited, all the timings were different. So they sent me back into the studio and I had to redo everything to fit the new timings. But what a difference. He completely brought that film to life. So a lot of it was the same scenes, but it was just the way the timing was, the way it was cut. And, you know, there's moments like when the kid, Michael Keaton character is watching TV, watching soap opera on TV, and the kid comes in and says, my grilled cheese is cold. And he takes the iron and he puts the iron on the toast and hands it back to him, you know. Just little things like that, you know, that wasn't in the, but then it was there in front of you and you crack up, you know, and the kid is like, oh, okay. You know, so it took those little nuances to know. I think a good comedy editor knew how to really focus you in on all those wonderful little nuances, which brought the film to life. Same thing in Splash. It's the timing, the way it was cut, the way it was edited. It was all so important, the way the flow to the whole thing.
I can imagine.
What bothers me now, Brett, sometimes I watch a comedy film nowadays, they've lost that touch. They'll say a joke, they'll say it again, they say it twice in case you didn't get it the first time, and then they'll repeat it again in the film. It's like, I got the joke the first time. Films like Splash and Mr. Mom don't do that. They do the joke once and they go on. They don't say anything. They just keep going on. And you're still back there laughing, you know? But films, a lot of comedy films have become very heavy-handed. And a lot of it's bathroom humor and stuff like that. It's like, it's not funny anymore, you know?
It makes me think of that notion, Lee, of trusting your audience. Like,
yes, yeah.
Believe your audience is more intelligent than they actually are.
I don't know what happened. It's there are very few contemporary comedic films I really like, because most of them are just way too heavy-handed.
So going back to Splash for a minute, it makes me wonder, you understand the plot of it being a romance between a businessman and a mermaid. How does that inform the flavor that you want to bring to the score and perhaps your conversations with Ron Howard?
Well, we talked a lot about the film. I don't know. He kept saying, well, it's underwater is a safe environment. That's all he said. But he just said, focus on the romance. That's it. And that really, that piano theme that I came up with was really the romance, you know, that's really what I was looking for. There were a lot more cues that I wrote for the film that weren't used, which I was disappointed about. They were afraid, they didn't want to over-romanticize the film.
Mm.
So they took some of the music out, which I thought was wrong, but on the CDs, we put it back. But still, anyway, I think I love that theme. I think that theme is still fresh today. And I think it's a very original theme. And it worked perfectly for that film.
And to clarify, you're talking about the Love Came For Me theme?
The Love theme, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's lovely, and it's also one that's infused into many different tracks in the film as well.
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes. Yes. And, you know, Disney had no idea the film would be a hit. They were totally unprepared. And the film opened that weekend and did gangbusters. And Disney was like Monday morning, what do we do now? You know, they had absolutely no preparation whatsoever for that film. And they never really merchandised it properly. I went to them immediately and said, okay, let's do a soundtrack album. You know, they didn't have their act together about that. So I had to eventually convince another company a few years later to make the soundtrack album separately. But Disney was completely unprepared for what came. And after that, they kind of got their act together, realized, oh, you know what? These films can do well and the music can do well, but they weren't ready for Splash.
Well, and it was also a time of big transition for the company.
Yes, yes.
Eisner and Wells came in. It was right during that same period.
Right, right. Yeah. It was a transitional time, yes.
Well, and I have to say the underwater cue for Splash is probably one of my favorites, because I feel like it captures the mystery of the seas. And
yeah, yeah.
I think it's a standout moment in the film because there's really, you know, no dialogue save for the mumble of the divers. I mean, it's just you're seeing Madison just swimming.
Yeah, that worked great. That was great. Yeah, I agree. I would pretty much given carte blanche on that. I kind of went for it. The big change was that I wrote that the whole finale was a piano orchestra thing. And then Disney said, oh, maybe we ought to have a song. So that's how the Rita Coolidge recording came about. But on a couple of classical albums, you could hear my piano extended version, you know, my own London Symphony album. And Eric Kunzel and the Cincinnati Pops also recorded the piano version. They did a beautiful recording of it. That's what I originally wrote when they swim off, was that piano orchestra thing. But they said, oh, no, let's have a song here. So we did the song, you know, and the song is great. But I also have a fondness for that classical piano orchestra rendition, which is on all the CDs.
I also remember from the score, the Madison at Bloomingdale's track.
Oh, yes. It
has a very 80s vibe.
Right. Well, it was the 80s.
Right. There's a timelessness and a timeliness to it. I seem to remember like some electric guitar.
It was some synths in it and electric guitar. Yeah, it had that little kind of rhythm section kind of thing going. But it was great. It was great. You know.
What are your emotions, or what were your emotions when you first saw Splash on the big screen with your score, if you recall that?
Well, you know, when you record, you conduct to picture. So, I mean, I was seeing it right then and there with the orchestra. I was kind of playing back the cues. For me, it worked beautifully. You know, I was very pleased with it. I liked what I was hearing back, so to speak. I think that one of the producers wanted like a more pop score, and I thought that was wrong, and I kind of fought with him a little bit about that. I felt that my feeling is that when you go with pop scores, you lock yourself into a time zone, you lock yourself into a period, and pop music changes every 6 months, so 6 months later you're going to be out of stock. My feeling was always to go for the more classic feeling because it's timeless. And I do feel that my score for Splash is more timeless. And it still sounds, you know, you can play it today and it's you know, it's a piece of music. I think if you delve too much on the pop side of things, you immediately are going to pigeonhole yourself. And it's a danger that many composers try to avoid because we all talk about it all the time. So don't get locked into that because it's like a hole that you'll go down you won't be able to get out of.
I can see that. And I think my comment about the Madison at Bloomingdale's track is I think that's like one of the very few moments where it feels reflective of the era, the score in its totality.
That was intentional. I was trying to make that statement. And of course, in that scene is that wonderful piece of dialogue when the sales lady says, looks at her outfit and says, oh my gosh, Did you see, you know, she just couldn't believe the way she was dressed, you know, and it's just like, she says, did you see Annie Hall 20 times or something like that? It was some great line about Annie Hall, but it was very much timely. That was a timely moment, you know,
right.
And it's Madison entering into the commercial real world of above on land, you know, so the 80s thing kind of felt like a good vibe then. Right. But most of the score, you know, doesn't try to be of the period. Most of the score is like a timeless kind of thing. And I think in a way, a love story is timeless. It should be timeless. You know, it shouldn't really fit into any kind of pigeonhole, so to speak.
Oh, I can definitely understand that. You know, I was thinking too, given that much of the score, you know, or not even the score, much of the film itself is kind of this, I don't want to say clash, but this notion between like modern city of Manhattan and then nature with the ocean.
Right.
It makes me wonder, Lee, in terms of how you made sense of really honoring the nature side, particularly because you mentioned your father, his background in science
Right.
climate issues. Yeah.
Well, my feeling again is that the sort of acoustic classic musical notion is something that fits in with that. It fits in with that. You're making music in a natural way. When you play the violin or you sing or you play the piano, it's a natural process of, I've often wondered what music must have sounded like in the early prehistoric days. You know, they were doing something. I wonder what they were doing. Were they singing? Were they banging on drums? What were they doing? All we can do is speculate. But making music is a very much part of the human nature and part of the human journey, so to speak. And if you make music sort of acoustically, if you play it yourself, you're very much expressing your own feelings, your own inner being. So it's a very natural process when you think about it.
So we were just talking about Splash, and I'm thinking to myself, it's a score that obviously is greatly appreciated, and it has been performed by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and in other spaces. What's your
Well,
understanding?
actually, quite a few orchestras around the world have included it in their concerts and their film concerts. It's a very well-liked piece, and it gets performed a lot. I must say, a number of pianists have told me they played it.
So what's your thoughts about your work being used in big concert settings that ultimately impact thousands of people in live time?
Well, I love that. That's kind of my background. When you think about the fact that I started out with that symphonic background, that was something that I was used to. I was used to going to symphonic concerts and things of that sort. To me, that was like a very natural form of expression. I love the whole concert hall idea. So to me, it was like coming home in a strange way. I was saying, yeah, the concert hall, I belong there.
And I know you also consider yourself to be a conductor. So what's it
Well,
like
yes,
for you?
I learned that it was very useful to be able to conduct my own scores because you kind of got things done quickly. Working at Universal, they wanted you to record at least 6 minutes, 4, 5, 6 minutes at each hour. So you had to really kind of run the session very rapidly, right? Quickly make decisions, spot a wrong note, fix it, go on, let's do it, let's record it. And it's a good, I think orchestras kind of appreciate it. They don't want long lectures about the motivation of music. Say, let's just play the music. You'll feel it.
Sounds like it's also just trusting that gut feeling of what feels
Yes,
the
yes.
sound right.
I think about a story that I heard years ago of Sir Thomas Beecham, the great English conductor, was preparing a concert with the Royal, with, not with the Royal, with the London Philharmonic. And he was there was he was rehearsing. They were doing a new piece, and they were doing the Brahms Second Symphony. And there was a young clarinetist who had just joined the orchestra for the first time, and he was playing his first rehearsal. And Sir Thomas spent the entire 3 hour rehearsal working on the new piece because that's the one that needed the work. They didn't know the work. Then he got to the end of the rehearsal and he said, "Gentlemen and ladies, we are also doing the Brahms Second. You all know that piece, you know?" And the young clarinetist raised his hand and, "But Sir Thomas, I've never played it before." And Sir Thomas said, "You'll enjoy it, my son. You will really enjoy it." So the point being is that, great music is just something you live with it, you play with it. It's a natural thing. It's something that you should be able to live with and enjoy and come back and visit often. It's like revisiting the well. I listen to Bach a lot, and I sort of get this. I say to myself sometimes that, well, there's Bach, and then there's all the rest of us. Because his music is like going back to the source. You go back to it and you say, okay, that's how music is written. It's just, it's like revisiting the Fountain of Youth again. I don't know. It's a fantastic feeling to go back to his music. And it kind of rekindles all the things, the reasons you love music all over inside yourself. All the little contrapuntal things and the approaches, the things that he does, the modulations. It's just fabulous. You know, it's like it takes you back to the source.
So in what ways do you revisit your own work, and or how have you learned from your past work to inform subsequent projects you handled?
Well, the thing about, as you know, we writers, we do the best we can in the circumstances. After a few years go by, you recognize that some things turned out better than others. You know, it's just a natural thing. There are certain scores I look back, I say, wow, that really worked. That's a great score. The others I say, nah, that didn't work so well. And maybe you can think sometimes the reasons it did work or it didn't work. I don't know. It's hard to know why. I think in terms of film music, you're only going to be as good as the film that you're, you know, I mean, you really, I've worked on some wonderful films. I've been very fortunate, and I've worked with some wonderful directors. And some of these directors sometimes have an amazing way of suggesting something that you may not have thought of. And I remember meeting a director once. He says, I don't know anything about music. I said, don't talk about music. Talk about the film. Talk about the drama. Tell me what you were thinking when you were filming, the story that you were telling. And they would come up with things. They would say things to me that I would say, oh, that's an idea. You know, the Beauty and the Beast TV series, the idea that the underworld was the safe place and the world above was the unsafe place. That was something that the original writer mentioned to me. And that idea stuck with me. And I said, you know what? When we're underground, it's diatonic, it's melodic, it's harmonic. When we go above ground, it's 12-tone, it's dissonant, it's disjointed, you know what I'm saying? It became a musical language for me, and it worked really well. If you go back to the pilot, you hear that. You hear the differences, you know, between the underworld and the upper world. And the famous theme that came out of it was that underworld, the beauty of it, so to speak, you know, and the feelings that they had for each other. And but that came from the man who produced it and wrote it. You know, it was his thought. The East of Eden miniseries, the director said to me, really, he said, I know the book is very long, but he said, it's basically there's the hate theme and there's the love theme. And it's all about that, you know, and that's all. He brought it down to like the essence. And the more I thought about it, the more I said, we're going to have that contrast between it. And in East of Eden, you do hear the threads of the theme that become the theme for the hate side of it. And then you hear the Eden theme, which is the love for the future and the better world and all of that kind of stuff. So those two melodic things run through the whole score, you know. And those are the kind of things you look for. It's all about drama. It's dramatization. It's what it is. In those early days of reading plays and wanting to write plays, it came in handy because very often I look at a film and I think of the playwright and I think of what are the themes here? What are they thinking about? And it kind of works out sometimes, you know.
See that. So how would you hope people, listeners, fellow musicians engage with your scores over the generations to come?
Well, it's, you know, you can't second guess what the future is going to bring, you know. There are pieces that you write that suddenly become classic, and then the things that you thought were going to become classic that don't become classic, you know. I've always said that music critics have been getting it wrong for 400 years, you know. That if you go back and read some of the reviews of Bach and some of the early music, they completely miss the boat. They completely miss the boat. And you know what they've been doing? They've been missing the boat ever since. The things that they say, this is great, this is greatness, this is a Nobel Prize, and blah, blah, blah. The piece disappears forever. And something that they, like Carmen, They trounced on that. The Parisian critics trounced on it. They thought it was a horrible opera. It's the worst thing ever written. It is just awful. So much so that Bizet became sick. He became ill after that and died not long after that. They, if you ever go back and read the reviews of that, original Parisian reviews of that opera, they're horrible. You'd think you were looking at a B-monster movie. But there was one person in the audience who watched the premiere and wrote to his brother and said, I have seen one of the finest operas ever written. And that person in the audience was Peter Tchaikovsky. And he wrote to his brother back in Moscow, and he said, this is one of the best operas ever written. And he said the opposite of what all those critics said. I wonder who was right. So my point being is that you can't second guess the future. I'm thrilled if something of mine, if people like it and want to revisit, I think it's wonderful. There are things that I thought would be great that nobody gives a frig about. And there are things that I'm surprised that suddenly find their way, you know. Back in 1976, I wrote a cue for a television movie. It was a kind of it was a science fiction crimes drama sort of thing. And the guy, the main character, his partner is killed in an incident. So he goes into a church and prays for him. And I wrote a little elegy for cello, viola, and strings, a little short piece to underscore that. And we did the session at Universal. And one of the two string players came to me and said, you know, we really like that cue. Would you consider expanding it into something larger? We'll play it on one of our upcoming chamber concerts. So I expanded the piece. It's the elegy for harp and strings. It wound up, they performed the piece, they premiered it. It wound up on a recording. It's been played all over the world. I get maybe 10, 20 requests for it a year to perform it. Who knew? I just wrote a short cue in a movie, and they're the ones that said they requested that I expand it, and I did. Brian Boitano skated to it, and it was recorded. There's a recording with the Nuremberg Symphony, the Elegy for Harp and Strings. You should look it up, and it's become like a classic. I didn't know that. I didn't know it would become a classic. Now I'm thrilled. I'm like, well, gee, that's wonderful. I'm so, you know, but at the time I wasn't thinking about it. I just said, okay, this sounds good.
Public response can be so unexpected, right? So some films may bomb when they first come out and then gain fandom later. Same with
right. That's happened. When I worked on a film called The Beastmaster, I thought it was a lot of fun. You know, I said, well, you know, it's kind of a sword and sorcery. It's kind of one of those kind of films. It's a cult classic. And it's recently been remastered for Blu-ray and all kinds of stuff. And they remastered the score. And I went to a premiere of it out in Silver Lake. And it sounded fantastic. And I said, who knew? And I wrote that score in about 2 weeks because they had thrown out the previous score. And they brought me in at the last minute. And I didn't sleep for 2 weeks and wrote the score. And I got some friends to help me with the orchestration, so we got it all done somehow. And I was just like, I didn't know what I wrote. I was like, whatever, let's just get the notes on the paper, you know, boom, boom, do it. Next thing I know, the film is a cult classic. And I'm like, you got to be kidding. And they've done, you know, they've done these big CDs of it and stuff like that. So you can second guess all you want. And that's why I think the critics often get it wrong, because they just don't, they think, oh, that's not a very good piece of music. And then it becomes a classic or something. You say, oh, this is destined to be a classic. And you never hear from it again.
It's so funny.
So, you know, it's very hard to your own self, if you know what I'm saying. I'm the last person I look at, you know. I mean, I might write a cue and I think that's wonderful. And I think, oh, that's great. And then I have to go to the market. So I go and get in my car and I put on my favorite classical station, and on comes something by Mozart or Bach or something. I said, oh, that's how you're supposed to compose. So I come home and rewrite the whole cue.
That's so funny. Lee, as we wrap up, I want to ask you some Disney opinion-related questions, given
Sure,
the
sure.
podcast we're on. And if you don't have answers for the questions, that's quite all right, but I'll ask
Okay.
them anyways. Growing up, was there a Disney soundtrack or piece of music that you listened to the most? So whether it be a
Well,
song or song, go
I
ahead.
loved it. I was amazed at some of the early, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea has a great score.
Yeah, Paul Smith, yeah.
A lot of people forget about that score. It's a marvelous score.
Oh, yes.
Fantasia, of course, was incredible. But I love the early Disney songs, and I thought those were gems. They were wonderful. I even love the cartoon stuff. I'm a big Warner Brothers cartoon fan. I think, recently everybody discovered that music and realized what great music that is. It's a very unique kind of music that has to be written a certain way, and you realize it's amazingly how they put that together and made it work, And so I don't know. Yeah, Disney was very much a part of that early days. I was very aware of. Hold on, I'm sorry. That's my fault. Yeah, sorry about that.
Oh, it's all right. I'll edit that out. All good.
Can you edit? Ask me the. Anyway, I'll pick up where I left off. Yes, the Disney films were very much a part of my early education. You couldn't escape it. You heard all those great early songs and the great scores. I mentioned 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. There were a number of those that I thought were wonderful, and Fantasia, of course, blew us all away, and so yes, Disney was very, very much a big part of it. But I come into Touchstone and to Splash, it was something different. I did realize. Now, I did do a number of other films. I did the Heidi miniseries for Disney, and I did a number of wonderful TV movies for them, and Big Business, which was a completely different kind of film,
I forgot
comedic.
you did Big Business.
Yeah,
Okay.
Big
I
Business.
love Big Business. Yeah,
Big
I was
Business
watching
is
it
a
recently.
riot. It's a riot. It's a very, very clever, funny film. And the score is kind of an eclectic combination of things, a bit of this, a bit of that, a bit of this, But yes, Disney was very much a presence growing up, and definitely.
Yeah, I only watched Big Business for the first time last year. And we were talking earlier about comedies, and sometimes they go kind of too far with it. I naturally laughed so loud with some of the scenes, and I'm like, that's a sign of a good comedy. I rarely ever laugh aloud.
Well, of course, I go back. I love the Ernst Lubitsch comedies from the 30s, the early black and white comedies, and I love that stuff. I love the early stuff, the Marx Brothers. Those are marvelous scripts. Have you ever really listened to what they're saying? Captain, the guy comes into the captain on the bridge. Captain, captain, there are four stowaways on board. And the captain looks at him and says, "How do you know there are four stowaways?" He said, "Because they're singing My Sweet Adeline." And it cuts to My Sweet Adeline in four-part harmony. I said, "That's genius. How do you know there are four?" So
That's
I
funny.
love all this stuff. I'm a big film buff and big fan of films. When I was in New York, I went to all the retro movie theaters, all the revivals, everything, Truffaut films, Fred Astaire films, you name it. I was there. I went to see all these things. So, and Disney was a big part of that. There were Disney festivals. So all this stuff is valuable. This is all our education. And I used to marvel at the Truffaut films. Georges Delerue would score with these little small groups. They didn't have big budgets, so he'd have like maybe eight musicians, but the scores were gems.
That's very cool. Is there, I have two more Disney music questions for you. Is there a Disney song that has gone stuck in your head, like an earworm?
Well, it's hard there's a lot of classic Disney songs, aren't there? I mean, it's hard to really, you can't pick one out and say, oh, that's the one. I mean, Certainly, there were wonderful songs in those early animated films. They're beautiful songs. They were all terrific. Wonderful songwriters, great classic American songwriters that wrote all those songs. You know, it's hard to, you know, When You Wish Upon a Star. I mean, it's a beautiful melodic, the way that melody develops. These songwriters were terrific. They wrote some beautiful songs, and they've stayed with us forever, haven't they?
Yeah. Is there, I know I'm asking you like singular answers, but is there a Disney movie that you feel has the most underrated music, or music that just doesn't get the love that you feel it should?
Oh gosh, it would be hard for me to think of one. I don't know. I'm not sure about that, Brett. I mean, I think most of the Disney films that had great music in them have been recognized. I think they have been. I can't think of one that has not, to be honest with you. Seems to me they've all pretty much come to the surface. You know?
And, I do. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I do agree with you on the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea score.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that was a very successful film.
Right.
But if you listen to the score, you realize it's a great score, too.
Right.
There are probably a few others. I'm sure if we dig around, we'll probably come up with some stuff. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm going to conclude with a final fun question, which is, if you could create a theme for a Disney character, which character would it be, and what would the personality of the theme be?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. You know, I mean, I did, you know, I come from the era in Costa Rica where before television, we got comic books, you know, so we had Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse. We had all those comic books, and we would read those comic books, and so any of those characters would be fine. I mean, I don't know what I would come up with. The guys that came up with those themes did amazing stuff. I wouldn't be able to replace them. I think they already covered that, you know, those wonderful composers that did all those scores. They were great. They did terrific stuff. They were classics. I'm happy that I came in when I came in, because that was more my genre anyway. And it's just fun to be part of the whole tapestry, you know. It's nice. It's a nice thing.
Maybe they could have a mashup at some point, a cartoon involving Donald Duck and Madison from Splash falling in love.
That would be interesting. What was that movie? What was that terrible movie about the duck? What am I thinking of?
Howard the Duck.
Howard the Duck, thank you. What a disastrous movie, though. What a disastrous movie. I'm glad I didn't score that. You know what I mean?
I feel like I have to ask the question then, Lee, because you brought it up. Is there a film that you've scored where you're thinking, oh, I really didn't like the movie, but the score is okay?
Oh, gosh.
Or we can talk about that offline, maybe.
Maybe offline. I don't want to mention names. I'm proud of their scores. I'm proud of Splash. I'm proud of Mr. Mom going Moonlighting. I love my theme for that. And the TV Beauty and the Beast. I thought those scores were beautiful. Again, classical symphonic scores. Coming into the 90s, the Tuskegee Airmen is one of my, the HBO film is one of my favorite scores that I wrote. Mists of Avalon, the miniseries, East of Eden. I love that. Old Gringo, I think I love my score for that. So there's certain ones that I look back and say, those are good scores. I did a good job. I paid attention and I did a good job. I did my homework.
Well, I think many listeners around the world would agree with you. And
I hope so. Not everybody agrees with me, but that's okay.
Well, and as we talked about, many are still performing them at different companies around the world.
Well, I'm thrilled about that. I'm thrilled about that. And I'm getting my guitar concerto premiered in 2 months, by the way.
Wow.
An orchestra in South America. So I don't give up. I keep going. I'm constantly looking for new territories and new horizons.
Well, Kudos to you. That is very cool.
Thank you.
Lee, thank you again for joining me
Okay,
on
Brett.
This episode today.
Pleasure talking to you.
Thanks again for joining me on another episode of Notably Disney. I invite you to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review. Follow me on Twitter at BNachmanReports. That's BNachmanReports. And be among the first to find out about the release of new episodes. I also encourage you to send me an email to notablydisney@gmail.com regarding your thoughts of the show, as well as suggestions for content. So until we turn the page on another chapter, I'm Brett, and thanks for listening to Notably Disney. Notably Disney is not affiliated with the Walt Disney Company or any of its subsidiaries. Consequently, the perspectives and opinions expressed by the host and guests are strictly theirs and do not represent the views of the Walt Disney Company and its employees. The main purpose of the Notably Disney podcast is to offer information and critiques about the Walt Disney Company.